This is Jay Sekulow, a special broadcast, the ACLJ and the courts.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the thief.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
Can't get no relief.
When the federal courts removed prayer from the public schools in 1962, the erosion of religious liberties took on new proportions. Soon, the use of the Bible for instruction or even reading was forbidden. And the traditional posting of the Ten Commandments as moral guides was prohibited because, according to the court's ruling, it was feared that students might try to follow them.
Phone lines are open for your questions right now.
No reason to get excited.
Call 1-800-684-3110. And now, Chief Counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow.
But you and I, we've been through that.
Welcome, everyone, to the broadcast. What we're doing this week is taking a look at key battles, key issues we're fighting for. We put together a special program. You're not going to want to miss it.
The truth is, you're going to see in the next little bit video that we've been archiving since the 1980s. But what's interesting about this, when I was reviewing everything and looking at the video, the truth of the matter is, when I look back on these cases, the cases reflected exactly what was going on in the culture at the time. So in the 1980s, for instance, the big issue for Christians was evangelism. It's always an issue, but it was a lot of legal challenges on evangelism. So we had these whole series of evangelism-related cases, including cases at the Supreme Court of the United States. And then in the 90s, it was the religion in the schools issues. And we had just, I mean, dozens of cases dealing with faith in school, students' rights in school, everything from graduation ceremonies to the Christmas song. And we've got the video of these young people who are now probably in their 30s that were, you know, 10 and 12 years old at the time or even younger. So it was good to look back and see where it's gone. Cases are actually a lot more complicated these days. The issues are more complicated. Things changed drastically, of course. Even in 2000, you saw in the late 80s, early 90s, we had the abortion cases. And those were the big cases at the Supreme Court. And then you had, I call the more complex cases. We had the election law cases, the FEC cases. And then we had a Ten Commandments case, which is still, I think, my most favorite case of all the cases. But we'll talk about that when we get to the Ten Commandments case. The very first case I argued at the Supreme Court of the United States actually was the very first appeal I ever argued. I never argued an appeal before. I was a trial lawyer. When I got out of law school, I worked with Chief Counsel's Office of the Department of the Treasury. The Internal Revenue Service was our client. And I was a trial lawyer. And at the time I left the IRS and went into private practice, I ended up on the board of directors of Jews for Jesus. And they had a case that was just kind of meandering through the lower courts, and it was distributing gospel tracts at an airport, which today would be very difficult after 9/11. But at the time, those airports were wide open. I mean, we didn't have the metal detectors. You didn't have the kind of security you have now. And the issue was the city of Los Angeles had passed this ban, which said no First Amendment activities inside an airport, which when you think about it is ridiculous. I mean, you say hello, that's a First Amendment activity. But what was interesting in two contexts was how I ended up with the case. We were at a board meeting, and the board of directors was having a discussion, and Moish Rosen, who recently passed away, was the executive director of Jews for Jesus. He said they looked at the budget, and they had no money. So they said, well, Jay's a lawyer, he can argue it. I was a tax lawyer.
We'll be back with more on the special broadcast, but folks, this is the most important time for the ACLJ when it comes to supporting our work, and so many of you have been gracious with your support. We're in a matching challenge. We're in the last few days of it here, folks, and we need your help. The next 2 weeks are critical for the ACLJ, and this is where you come in. Any amount that you donate, we get a matching gift for. And what that means is literally, if you donate $10, we get $20. If you donate $500, we get $1,000. And many of you have. But we have a big goal for this month. On air alone, through the internet, we're looking at raising close to $2 million for our ACLJ budget. I really need your help on this. If you've thought about supporting the ACLJ, this is the month to do it. The easiest way is just go to ACLJ.org. In the right-hand corner, it will say donate, your gift doubled. Right on the homepage, ACLJ.org. We'll also have links on Facebook as well. And you could call in your pledge right now at 1-877-989-2255. So, folks, this is the time of year when we're asking for your financial help. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. Back with more in a moment.
It has never been a busier time for the ACLJ than it is right now. Across the globe and here at home, the ACLJ is on the front lines defending religious freedom and protecting human rights. Whether it's our commitment to free American pastor Saeed Abedini imprisoned in Iran or battling it out in court to stop pro-abortion Obamacare, the ACLJ is standing up for you. As 2013 draws to a close, your support, your prayers are more important than ever. The work we do could not occur without you. And now, for a limited time, your gift will be double. A $25 gift becomes $50, $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's matching challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The matching challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at aclj.org, or you can call 1-877-989-2255. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to know that the American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow.
We are very grateful. I want to say this, a huge thank you to our friends and members from literally from coast to coast. Because of the generosity of our members, we've added new lawyers. We're handling international affairs as high as even the United Nations. A lot of issues going on, a lot of great things happening, and a huge thank you to our friends and members around the country.
With an exceptional track record of success, the American Center for Law and Justice is on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. There's no better place to get the facts, the truth, about the issues that matter most to you and your family than at the ACLJ website. Learn more about our work and our defense of freedom online at aclj.org.
Broadcast, everyone. As I mentioned, as we go back into our special broadcast here, I want to encourage you to support the work of the ACLJ. We're in that matching challenge. You can call in your pledge at 1-877-989-2255. That's 877-989-2255. If you want to stand with us, and we encourage you to do it, or simply go to aclj.org. It's aclj.org or 1-877-989-2255. Now back to special programming.
The biggest problem was, and you'll see this when we look at the case, was not only was it my first time at the Supreme Court of the United States, religion cases had done terrible at the Supreme Court of the United States, primarily because of the way they were presented. I think it was just kind of the free exercise clause, which is one of the First Amendment issues, a free exercise clause. It hadn't done very well at the Supreme Court. So I argue this as a speech case. But my favorite was a question that came from Chief Justice Rehnquist to Jim Capel. I still remember the lawyer that argued the case for the city of Los Angeles. He never argued a case at the Supreme Court of the United States either, so it was both of us were first time. And he asked the lawyer asked the question of the court kind of as a statement. You know, he said, what is an airport authority supposed to do? And Chief Justice of the United States, William Rehnquist, who was not one that was prone to humor, said, well, one thing you could do is get someone that knows how to write a statute that would comply with the First Amendment. I thought that was pretty good for my side. Sometimes the less you say is more. But the case was fascinating, mostly, I think most significantly, because it was a religion case, and we ended up winning the case unanimously before the Supreme Court of the United States. One of the periodicals called my oral argument rude, aggressive, and obnoxious. And I think the rude and aggressive part was right. I don't think the obnoxious was correct, but I think that was rude and aggressive and obnoxious in their eyes because they envisioned, you know, if Floyd Abrams, who was this noted First Amendment lawyer, would have made the same argument I made, they would have said, great oral argument, aggressive. But, you know, they expect Christian lawyer in the 1980s, you're just going to be kind of, you know, meek and mild, manageable, and, you know, I was born in Brooklyn and I'm not meek nor mild nor very manageable, but this is the very first case. I was at a board meeting at Jews for Jesus. I was on the board at the time, and the executive director said, we've got a case. The Supreme Court had just granted review. It was about literature distribution at airports, evangelism at airports.
The Ninth Circuit had allowed the evangelism to take place, but the Supreme Court had accepted the case for review, and the thought was that they were going to reverse and not allow evangelism to take place.
The case is called Board of Airport Commissioners of Los Angeles versus Jews for Jesus. That case has affected every airport in the United States, opening them to personal evangelism and literature distribution.
I looked at all the cases involving religious distribution of literature and what's called the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution and how it applied to religious evangelism. And basically, our side lost every single time. So maybe it was just me being naive in this sense. I said, you know, that area of law is not worked out very well, this whole free exercise issue. Let's approach this a different way. If this was a union organizer wanting to distribute literature at the airport for a union organization, would the Supreme Court of the United States say, no, you can't do that? Of course not. Of course they would allow it. Well, then why would it be different if it was religious speech? And then I came up with this idea of let's argue these cases as speech cases, not simply a free exercise case. So when I went to the Supreme Court of the United States, my entire pitch in that case was this case is about freedom of speech. And I barely mentioned religion in the entire oral argument. Here we argued, no matter what the category that you're engaged in here, no matter how you view the area, the fact of the matter is you can't have a resolution that says in a public place you can't engage in free speech activities. After all, me talking to you right now is a free speech activity. Saying hello at the airport is a free speech activity. You can't let the government dictate the contents of speech when it's protected speech as religious speech is. So we argued that it was both protected speech, that religious speech should be treated no differently than any other form of speech, and secondly, that you've got to allow robust debate in the marketplace of ideas.
The United States Supreme Court today struck down one major public airport's rules against groups using terminals to seek donations or converts. Los Angeles International Airport had tried to outlaw any free speech activity not related to the airport itself. Supreme Court justices ruled unanimously today that such a blanket ban is unconstitutional.
Nine justices of the Supreme Court, the most conservative and the most liberal, agreed that that resolution for the city of Los Angeles, which said no First Amendment activities at the Los Angeles International Airport, all nine justices agreed that, in fact, that was unconstitutional. So it was a huge win for religious free speech, probably the most significant win that we'd seen in 50 years.
In 1987, the United States Supreme Court issued a unanimous opinion that opened the door for evangelism and distribution of literature in the nation's airports.
Because of that decision to Jews for Jesus, we opened up areas of evangelism literally from coast to coast. I mean, we marched around the country defending evangelism in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, Atlanta, Texas, Southern California, Northern California, and points in between. And we won all of those cases because of a unanimous decision in Jews for Jesus. I'll never forget Moish Rosen, the head of Jews for Jesus. As we walked out the Supreme Court, we went to the back to get into the cars. He said, I think you're going to be back here often. And I said, Moish, you don't get back here often. Most lawyers never. I mean, not 1% of the lawyers in America, not 1/10 of 1% of the lawyers in America ever argue one case before the Supreme Court of the United States, let alone many. And I've had cases now in the 1980s, the 1990s, and through 2010 at the Supreme Court of the United States. And every time I go, it doesn't change. I think the expectations of the justices are higher because you've been there a lot. But the excitement and enthusiasm and sheer awe of the moment has not changed one bit for me.
So another interesting aspect of this case was another question that came up by Thurgood Marshall. And this is when you're trying to count, you know, you got to get to five. I mean, like I always say, I'm not a great math student, but I could count to five. If you don't get to five, you don't win. And at the close of the argument, Thurgood Marshall, who we modeled a lot of our work after, who was headed up the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, ended up, was on the Second Circuit, was a Solicitor General, ended up at the Supreme Court of the United States. He turned to the lawyer, after all the arguments, and he turned to the lawyer again, to Jim Capel, and he says, I've heard your arguments now, you know, for 30 minutes. Exactly what is it about these people that you don't like? Because it was so targeted. It was also because of the Olympics were coming to Los Angeles. And that was a lot of what was going on here. And they were trying to, you know, keep, quote, the clutter out. By the way, Jews for Jesus never solicited money. The case had nothing to, despite Dan Rather's comment, the case had nothing to do with solicitation of funds. It was distribution of literature only. But it was a great decision. And you know, we were able to march it around the country. But it led to another issue that was percolating. And that was about the same time There was this act of Congress had passed called the Equal Access Act, and it was to allow student-led prayer and Bible clubs in public schools. The problem with the act was that the law was great, but a lot of courts were determining it to be unconstitutional, violating church-state separation establishment clause. And the interesting side note on this case was another legal group actually was handling the case. But then it got, you know, certiorari was granted, and Pam and I actually took the lawyer that was going to originally argue the case out to dinner in Atlanta to the Coach and Six restaurant. I'll never forget this. And to talk him through it. And he was really worried about it. And he'd never done an appeal either. I said, well, neither did I. I've never done an appeal either. This was my first one. He said, but you won, and this is an Establishment Clause case. It's much more complicated. It's really a free speech case, I kept telling him. End result of all of that was he determined he's not going to be able to do that case. So the law group that had it said, well, we need a lawyer that's been successful at the Supreme Court of the United States on a religion case. Well, there was only one, and it was me. So now I was the expert. I had one case, and I was the expert. The difficulty with this case was it was pitched in the lower courts as a religion case, an Establishment Clause case, and I really wanted to argue this as a student free speech case because this was a big issue. 15,000 public schools, there were just a handful of Bible clubs going on at the time.
We'll be back with more on the special broadcast, but folks, this is the most important time for the ACLJ when it comes to supporting our work, and so many of you have been gracious with your support. We are in a matching challenge. We're in the last few days of it here, folks, and we need your help. The next 2 weeks are critical for the ACLJ, and this is where you come in. Any amount that you donate, we get a matching gift for, and what that means is literally, if you donate $10, we get $20. If you donate $500, we get $1,000, and many of you have. But we have a big goal for this month. On air alone, through the internet, we're looking at raising close to $2 million for our ACLJ budget. I really need your help on this. If you've thought about supporting the ACLJ, this is the month to do it. The easiest way is just go to aclj.org. In the right-hand corner, it will say Donate Your Gift Doubled right on the homepage, aclj.org. We'll also have links on Facebook as well. And you could call in your pledge right now at 1-877-989-2255. So, folks, this is the time of year when we're asking for your financial help. aclj.org or 1-877-989-2255. Back with more in a moment.
The American Center for Law and Justice is on the front lines, holding the Internal Revenue Service accountable for a targeting scheme aimed at conservative and Tea Party groups. The ACLJ represents 41 organizations in 22 states in the largest lawsuit against the IRS on behalf of targeted Americans. Now it is time for the story to be told. The ACLJ has put together a short movie telling the story and explaining the high stakes of our fight against IRS abuse. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sat down with Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, Dr. Ben Carson, and many national leaders to tell this critical story. You can watch this movie free of charge. Go online to download this powerful new film, Tax Invasion, at aclj.org. That's aclj.org. It has never been a busier time for the ACLJ than it is right now. Across the globe and here at home, the ACLJ is on the front lines defending religious freedom and protecting human rights. Whether it's our commitment to free American pastor Saeed Abedini imprisoned in Iran or battling it out in court to stop pro-abortion Obamacare, the ACLJ is standing up for you. As 2013 draws to a close, your support, your prayers are more important than ever. The work we do could not occur without you. And now, for a limited time, your gift will be doubled. A $25 gift becomes $50. $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's matching challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The matching challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at ACLJ.org, or you can call 1-877-989-2255.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. A very special programming for you. We're nearing the final days of our matching challenge, and that's where you come in. We encourage you to help us. Go to ACLJ.org. Make that online gift now, ACLJ.org, or call us at 1-877-989-2255. Now back to special programming.
The turning point for religious liberty in this country was clearly the Mergen's case involving Bible clubs, because it set a different tone. It said, no longer will expressions of faith be removed from the public school as if they were somehow subversive or against each other. And that changed the way people thought about religious practice and religious faith, not just in schools, but then across the board.
We wanted to have the Bible study meet in the school, and we thought it'd be no problem to start. But it turned into a problem when the principal said, no, you can't have it.
They may not meet under the present ruling of the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit if that speech involves some sort of religious thought.
Is it a freedom of speech question in your opinion?
It is not. No, sir. Do you think that high school students and grammar school students should have equal rights with college students?
Do you?
No, sir.
They have the right to meet, and they should have the right to meet, because this is a democracy.
The public schools are really no places for religious meetings, for masses, for revival meetings, for prayer meetings.
Congress saw this widespread discrimination, and that's what it was, against religious speech, Christian speech in particular. They passed in 1984, after extensive hearings, the Equal Access Act.
All it does is say that if a school allows a Young Republicans Club or a Kiwanis Club to meet, equal treatment must be given to religious groups.
The ayes are 270, the noes are 151, two-thirds of those present not having voted in the affirmative. The rules are not suspended and the bill is not passed.
With that vote, the House of Representatives initially defeated the Equal Access Act. But when the bill was taken up in the Senate, it passed easily and opened the door for the House of Representatives to follow suit. Senator Jeremiah Denton sponsored the Senate version of the Equal Access Act.
There was like a sealed door, which was keeping the any practice of, any expression of religious thought out of the schools. There's one ruling after another we can cite, one case after another. Now that seal has been broken. That's the big thing. This is more than a foot in the door. This is an epic change.
Mergen's lawsuit has emerged as a major test of the Federal Equal Access Act, a 1984 law which says if public schools make their facilities available for non-curriculum related activities, religious groups must get the same access.
Well, they said that We don't allow religious groups like that to meet in the school because of the separation of church and state. And I said, well, the Equal Access Act gives us access to meet.
But the school board claimed that campus religious meetings would violate the Constitution's ban against government-sponsored religion.
Bridget Mergens stood before the school board and asked that she be allowed to have a prayer club and a Bible club meet on her public high school campus. And they were denied that right, even with the Equal Access case. 1989, when they made the request to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court said, yes, we're going to hear the Mergens case.
In today's Supreme Court hearing, the lawyer for the school board argued the 1984 law shouldn't apply because the activities of all the other student groups were related to classwork, that chess, for example, related to math and logic. The lawyer for the students countered that the school board was violating free speech. Solicitor General Kenneth Starr told the justices the primary thrust of the Equal Access Act was to protect religious liberty and free speech.
It's clear that the court was interested in really the implementation of the Equal Access Act, not so much its constitutionality, which is we're very pleased to see. I think that student free speech on the high school campus, when it's religious, is going to be protected. It seems clear that the direction the court was going in was one of how do we implement this type of free speech on a high school campus rather than whether it should even take place to begin with.
I called the clerk for months. Has there been a decision in Board of Education versus Mergens? Not yet. Called at 10:20 on June 4th. It's getting near the end of the term. Has there been a decision yet? Not yet. 2 minutes later, we have an office in Washington. My associate calls me and says, Jay, there's been a decision. I said, no, Jim, there has not. He'd been doing this to me for about 3 weeks. He goes, no, I'm really holding it. I said, I don't believe you, but go ahead and tell me.
On June 4th, 1990, the United States Supreme Court issued a landmark decision. 8 of the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled in favor of Mergins.
By a surprisingly decisive margin, the Supreme Court ruled today that a student Bible study club has as much right to meet in a public school as any other group. The vote was 8-1.
By an 8-1 margin, the court ruled that student prayer groups must be allowed to meet in public schools that permit other organized extracurricular activities.
Speaking for the court, Sandra Day O'Connor said that high school students are mature enough to understand that permitting Bible clubs would not be an endorsement of religion. The court's liberals approved for a different reason. They called it a freedom of speech case.
In Mergins, the court said that when students talk about God, there is no violation of the so-called separation of church and state. The court also said that handing out Christian literature is protected by the First Amendment.
It's called pristine speech. It's the highest form of First Amendment activity. The distribution of religious literature on a public school campus is protected because religious literature distribution has always been protected.
There was no way. That's what the world said, that you'd have prayer and Bible studies back in a public school. No way. And then the decision came out. And it wasn't just a little victory, it was 8 justices out of 9. What does that say? God answers the prayer of his people.
So the interesting aspect of the case, and you saw that in the news reports, they were stunned that the court ruled 8-1. I mean, when I went and did these practice sessions, these moot court sessions, I mean, everybody thought we were going to get clobbered. But the end result of that case, and I think significantly, was it completely changed the whole, and you'll see this, the whole student religion issue. For instance, there was no see you at the poll until the school year after this one, after this case. Just think about this, no prayer and Bible clubs in school, no literature distribution, no see you at the poll, none of those events took place. So you had this decision that comes out of the Supreme Court, which shocks the left. I mean, shocks them. That was an ACLU lawyer that was interviewed. It was the ACLU was saying students had no free speech rights. When the reporter asked him, you know, he said, well, do you think they have free speech rights? Absolutely not. This is the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, saying that students had no free speech rights on campus. But they only wanted it for one reason, and that's because the speech involved religion. And so this was the ACLU had never been confronted with a free speech argument where they had to find themselves on the other side against free speech. So they were arguing, and I said this in the oral argument, they were arguing for censorship. I mean, they were basically saying these students walk in the schoolhouse gate, they have nothing, no free speech rights. And there were cases from the 1960s that said students had the right to freedom of speech and they didn't shed their rights at the schoolhouse gates. We just had to take that from general political protest, it was actually protesting the Vietnam War, into the context of a religious speech.
That's going to do it for the broadcast today, folks. Again, I encourage you, join with us. Become part of the team here at the ACLJ. Any amount you donate, we get a matching gift for, and that helps us fight for freedom around the world. ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. Remember, you can listen to the full hour on SiriusXM. If not, just go to ACLJ.org. We're streaming there. Back with your calls in a moment.
For a limited time, your gift will be double. A $25 gift becomes $50. $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's matching challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The matching challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at ACLJ.org or you can call 1-877-989-2255.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. As I mentioned, as we go back into our special broadcast here, I want to encourage you to support the work of the ACLJ. We're in that matching challenge. You can call in your pledge at 1-877-989-2255. That's 877-989-2255. If you want to stand with us, and we encourage you to do it, or simply go to ACLJ.org. It's ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. Now back to special programming.
After the decision came out, it took about 5 years of additional litigation in other cases to get this issue resolved, to really get the courts to understand the scope of the decision. It was very broad. I mean, Justice O'Connor said that there's a crucial difference between government speech endorsing religion, which is prohibited by the Establishment Clause, and private speech endorsing religion, which she said was protected by the Free Speech Clause, which is exactly what we argued. It's not often that you see your argument actually reflected in the decision, but what you're also seeing through this, what we're talking about here is we built on, I mean, we took the Jews for Jesus precedent and applied it to the Bible Club's cases. It was basically the same argument. You could take out the people, put in a different time frame. This was now the 1990s, and there it is. We had to wait a long time for that case to come down. But it was interesting in that case that you had the three most liberal members of the court, the three most liberal, Thurgood Marshall, Justice Brennan, and Justice Stevens, all say not only were we right statutorily, but we were right under the Free Speech Clause. And that was the ACLU was stunned after that. We did these conferences afterwards, and they're still, when I was at a conference actually at the Heritage Foundation just a few weeks ago, and it was on another issue, but one of the lawyers that was on the panel was also on the other side of Mergen's. And she said, they still can't figure out how we won that case. The untold story here is, in this case and another one, I actually appeared before the trial court judges that ruled against us in other cases. And in both of the cases that I was argued subsequently at the district court level, the judges would always bring up, in this particular one, you know, Mergen's was not the same case that you represented to the Supreme Court of the United States that was argued here before me. And I had the same thing in the Lamb's Chapel case, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But Mergen's was, you know, if you had to say one case that had just huge impact, instantaneously huge impact, it was Mergen's. I mean, it wasn't technical. There was no wiggle room. There were eight justices that agreed with you. It was a big win. And in retrospect, one of the most significant. But then, at the same time that was all brewing, we had the protests on abortion, and those cases were tough. You had thousands of individuals involved, and the cases, a couple of times, ended up at the Supreme Court of the United States. And the first one had a really unbelievable twist to it. So let's take a look. As the case came to the Supreme Court of the United States, we realized that this could be a capstone. This could be a really significant victory for the pro-life movement that 20, 30, and 40 years from now could be looked upon as a crowning achievement. This was a movement that had birthed in the mid-80s, and pro-life, what were called rescues, where you had these mass sit-ins, sometimes of tens of thousands of people, reached their zenith in the 90s, in the early 90s, and these cases had been percolating up through the courts and ultimately to the Supreme Court of the United States. I was crisscrossing the country in those days. One day I'd be in New York, the next day in Texas, then out in Wichita. I mean, we were all over the country on a weekly basis handling a different Operation Rescue protest case. It was just part of what we did.
Here's what happened. The pro-choice movement was humming along. No real opposition per se on a grassroots level, no threat. And then suddenly, hundreds of people are coming into the streets kneeling at clinics. And they completely freaked out.
We're going to be back with more of this special programming. As we get ready for a break, folks, we need you to go to ACLJ.org. We appreciate your financial support. It's tax deductible. Any amount you donate, we get a matching grant for, folks. We're in the most important last couple of days of the year here for us. And we need your help as we're really about 2 weeks out from the close of the year, a little bit less. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. Any amount you donate, we get a matching gift for. So I encourage you, go to ACLJ.org. Right in the right-hand corner, it says donate now. You can make that donation online or call us at 1-877-989-2255.
It has never been a busier time for the ACLJ than it is right now. Across the globe and here at home, The ACLJ is on the front lines defending religious freedom and protecting human rights. Whether it's our commitment to free American pastor Saeed Abedini imprisoned in Iran or battling it out in court to stop pro-abortion Obamacare, the ACLJ is standing up for you. As 2013 draws to a close, your support, your prayers are more important than ever. The work we do could not occur without you. And now, for a limited time, your gift will be double. A $25 gift becomes $50, $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's matching challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The matching challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at aclj.org, or you can call 1-877-989-2255. The American Center for Law and Justice is on the front lines, holding the Internal Revenue Service accountable for a targeting scheme aimed at conservative and Tea Party groups. The ACLJ represents 41 organizations in 22 states in the largest lawsuit against the IRS on behalf of targeted Americans. Now it is time for the story to be told. The ACLJ has put together a short movie telling the story and explaining the high stakes of our fight against IRS abuse. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sat down with Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, Dr. Ben Carson, and many national leaders to tell this critical story. You can watch this movie free of charge. Go online to download this powerful new film, Tax Invasion, at aclj.org. That's aclj.org.
Welcome to the broadcast, everyone. We're going to take a look back on some of those key struggles for freedom that we've been fighting for.
Well, we literally clashed philosophies in the street. We would have maybe
sometimes
only 15 or 20 people outside an abortion clinic. We might be on our knees praying. We might be carrying signs. We might be making announcements through a bullhorn. And the police would come and set up a police tape and keep the other side, the pro-abortion side, on the other side of the police tape. So you would literally have these two lines facing one another. There's usually a little space in between. So you'd have the pro-life side and the pro-abortion side across a police barrier.
We were spit on, urine thrown in our face, kicked, clubbed, it goes on and on. Because for the first time since 73, I think the pro-choice movement recognized, oh my gosh, this is something really serious.
It could get pretty nasty. I mean, there were times when I was punched, I was spit on. On one occasion, I was urinated on as I knelt to pray. We had cigarettes put out in our hair. So it got pretty edgy. And sometimes violent.
On this day, October 16th, 1991, these people were lined outside the United States Supreme Court building waiting to get a seat to hear arguments on a case called Bray versus Alexandria Women's Health Clinic. At stake was whether federal courts should use their authority to stop pro-life advocates from blocking entrance to abortion facilities.
The pro-life movement, like every other social protest movement, must be protected by the First Amendment.
In our view, anyone attempting to block a clinic, for example, and prevent someone from going inside an abortion clinic is interfering with that person's exercise of that fundamental right.
The case that was just argued is a case in which the court will decide whether women are going to have any protection against illegal attacks by mobs and vigilantes.
The operators of these abortion clinics were arguing that opposition to abortion was discriminatory action against women seeking abortion. And we said that's ridiculous. There are both men and women on the pro-life side. They're not discriminating against women. They're protecting the unborn child.
What other group do you know of that has federal lawsuits being brought against them when they block facilities? None.
What these respondents were trying to do is stamp a badge of illegitimacy on a social protest movement. And the federal courts do not need to become monitors of state trespass actions, and that's all this is. It's a state trespass action. At best, it's a obstruction statute, and that's what's involved here. And these should have been in the state courts, and federal courts should not be put in the position of stifling civil disobedience.
We made it a very narrow case, and sometimes that's the best strategy at the Supreme Court of the United States. We had lost in the lower court, so our job was to win. How do you win a case like that involving abortion protests and the federal statutes are involved? We said the case had no business being in federal court, that if someone blockaded an abortion clinic, at best, it would be a state trespass action. It would not be a federal claim.
Abortion advocates use the argument that pregnant women seeking abortions are a special class of people and therefore should be protected under an 1871 law called the Ku Klux Klan Act.
Well, I think the key issue is that women are a protected class, or women seeking abortions are a protected class under this particular law.
As a woman and an attorney, I don't feel that what these people are doing by sitting in clinics is exploitative of women or discrimination against women.
No way could they apply this KKK law to the effort on the part of the pro-lifers to save lives.
The lower courts have interpreted the KKK Act to cover class-based hostility. The question is whether pregnant women seeking abortions are a legitimate class under that statute.
The fact that they're being targeted because they are pregnant makes them a protected class.
They have tried to bludgeon us and to crush this movement by an illegitimate use of the federal judiciary. This is simply about trespass or disorderly conduct. If we win, it's a victory for all protest groups.
The law has gone haywire. It's so far outside of the scope of what the Ku Klux Klan Act was supposed to do. The trial judge himself said that this was basically a simple trespass action. Then why don't they treat it like one?
What was interesting about that case was that I had argued the case at the beginning of the term, which was October, and here we were at the end of the term with no decision yet. Now, also, Thurgood Marshall had resigned. He did not hear the case, and Clarence Thomas had not yet been confirmed. So I argued the case in October, expecting to get a decision, knowing it was a controversial case. It was involving abortion protests towards the end of the term, which would be June. I got a call in June, all right, but it was not a decision. It was the court requesting re-argument. So we had that summer to prepare for a re-argument, and they asked one additional question. So the initial thought was that it was 4-4 and it was a tie, but when we saw the questions that were asked, we realized there was much more to it.
The Supreme Court granted unlimited certiorari in Bray, which meant that all the questions proposed in the petition to the court could be entertained.
We took it out of the context of abortion and put it into the context generally of civil disobedience. Would you turn the axe of Martin Luther King Jr. when he was encouraging civil disobedience, like the blockades of the lunch counters that were segregated? Would you encourage that to be a federal case against Martin Luther King? And the answer would be no, of course not. At best, it would be a trespass action.
The opinion of the court in number 90985 Bray against Alexandria Women's Health Clinic will be announced by Justice Scalia.
The district court ruled that petitioners had violated this federal statute by conspiring to deprive women seeking abortions of their right to interstate travel, and also ruled for respondents on state law claims of trespass and public nuisance. As relief, the court enjoined future demonstrations and, based on the Section 1985-3 finding, ordered petitioners to pay respondents attorney's fees and costs. The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit affirmed. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we essentially reverse. Respondents are not entitled to relief under the first clause of Section 1985-3. Our precedents hold that to establish a violation of that section, a plaintiff must show that the conspirators acted with some racial or otherwise class-based, invidiously discriminatory animus. Opposition to abortion does not qualify as a class-based animus, nor does opposition to abortion reflect an invidiously discriminatory animus against women in general. Men and women are on both sides of petitioners' demonstrations, and our precedents indicate that the disfavoring of abortion is not ipso facto invidious discrimination against women as a class.
And the Supreme Court was very clear, and they said opposition to abortion is not discrimination against women. We had six justices of the Supreme Court agree with us, so it became a very significant decision, one that holds to this day. The most difficult part of that case was the re-argument. I mean, we argued the case the second week of the term. It started in October. First Monday in October, the case starts. We were the second week, and it was the very last day. And I called the clerk of the court and the deputy clerk of the court. I remember the conversation. Sandy Nelson. She said, we got an order, but it's not a decision. They want the case re-argued. And we all thought at that point it was 4-4. It was a tie, and then Clarence Thomas was confirmed, and we were going to argue the case, and it would be 5-4. The decision came out, it was 6-3 in our favor. So we're not exactly sure what the reason was, but I got to work with John Roberts on that one, who's now, of course, the Chief Justice of the United States. He was the Deputy Solicitor General at the time. Another side note on this case is that I was argued a companion case in Wichita, Kansas, and it was in the summer. It was called the Summer of Mercy, and it wasn't just hundreds or thousands of people. 15,000 people showed up for this, and the judge was Judge Patrick Kelly, and I still remember this because we started the case, and we were arguing whether this law applied and whether federal authority could even be brought into it, and he started the case by saying, Mr. Sekulow, just make sure of one thing. Make sure your clients bring their toothbrush to court. They bring their toothbrush to court? Because he was planning on putting them all in jail that afternoon. I mean, he had already decided what it was going to be. But the trial went on for a few days, and at the second day, I get a call from to do Nightline, which was a very big program in those days. And originally, I was going to go to the studio in Wichita, and it was going to be me on one side and Lawrence Tribe from Harvard on the other. So we were going to debate the case. Well, I get in the car that the network, I learned that lesson, don't ever do that. So the network sent a car, so we get in the car, and we didn't have a media representative then, it was just us. And I said, well, we're supposed to be going to the studio, and it looks like, which is downtown, but it looks like we're going to the abortion clinic. And he goes, well, that's where they're gonna film you, they want you in front of the abortion clinic. With 15,000 people behind me, 104 degrees in Wichita, Kansas. And there was a surprise third guest on the television program. Barbara Walters was hosting it that night. The third guest was Judge Patrick Kelly. So I had the federal court judge that's hearing the case now before the American people arguing why I was wrong.
We're going to be back with more of this special programming. As we get ready for a break, folks, we need you to go to ACLJ.org. We appreciate your financial support. It's tax deductible. Any amount you donate, we get a matching grant for, folks. We're in the most important last couple of days of the year here for us. And we need your help as we're really about 2 weeks out from the close of the year, a little bit less. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. Any amount you donate, we get a matching gift for. So I encourage you, go to ACLJ.org. Right in the right-hand corner, it says donate now. You can make that donation online or call us at 1-877-989-2255 and say, I am standing with Jay Sekulow and the ACLJ team. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255.
The American Center for Law and Justice is on the front lines, holding the Internal Revenue Service accountable for a targeting scheme aimed at conservative and Tea Party groups. The ACLJ represents 41 organizations in 22 states in the largest lawsuit against the IRS on behalf of targeted Americans. Now it is time for the story to be told. The ACLJ has put together a short movie telling the story and explaining the high stakes of our fight against IRS abuse. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow sat down with Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, Dr. Ben Carson, and many national leaders to tell this critical story. You can watch this movie free of charge. Go online to download this powerful new film, Tax Invasion, at ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org. It has never been a busier time for the ACLJ than it is right now. Across the globe and here at home, the ACLJ is on the front lines defending religious freedom and protecting human rights. Whether it's our commitment to free American pastor Saeed Abedini imprisoned in Iran or battling it out in court to stop pro-abortion Obamacare, the ACLJ is standing up for you. As 2013 draws to a close, your support, your prayers are more important than ever. The work we do could not occur without you. And now, for a limited time, your gift will be double. A $25 gift becomes $50. $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's matching challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The matching challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at ACLJ.org or you can call 1-877-989-2255.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. A very special programming for you. We're nearing the final days of our matching challenge, and that's where you come in. We encourage you to help us. Go to ACLJ.org. Make that online gift now, ACLJ.org, or call us at 1-877-989-2255. Now back to special programming.
So we, you know, jostle it out on, you know, kind of duke it out on stage in front of all these people around the country that were watching pre-cable. And there were a little bit of cable, I guess, in those days. And the next day, I'm supposed to go before him. So Pat Monahan, one of my law partners, and I said, we got to ask him to, he's got to go. He can't hear this case. He's like a cheerleader for the other side. So I decided, well, I'm going to make a motion for recusal to get him out of the case. But I want to do that in chambers. I don't want to embarrass him. Media was all over this. There were a lot of media there. He got really upset the day before because I got a call from John Roberts, and he said that the United States was going to file a brief on our side. And when they did, I'm telling you, the U.S. attorney for Wichita filed that brief. This was not a happy Judge Kelly. Well, he thought I was going and talking about that. And so we get back, and I walk in. I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was 23 years ago. I walk into his chambers, and he has his feet up on his desk. And he's smoking a cigarette. They used to do that in federal buildings then. And I walk in, and he jumps up from behind the desk. And he comes around his desk and gives me this bear hug. And said, we made history last night. Yeah, we did all right. And he goes, what do you need to talk to me about? I said, I need to ask you to recuse yourself. And I mean, he turned, green. He was infuriated. And he said, I am not recusing myself. I said, well, then I'm going to walk upstairs and ask the 10th Circuit to recuse you. Because the federal courthouse had the district court on one level and the 10th Circuit was upstairs. And I did. Now, you got to understand something. No emails, no internet, computers, barely, fax machines. That was a big thing. And we wrote the order out in handwriting and took it up to the 10th Circuit, and they pulled him off the case. He was not a happy guy. And of course, that case with Bray ended up going to the Supreme Court. We had the re-argument, and we won the case. And the best part of that win was, what we argued the whole time was that opposition to abortion was not discrimination against women, and the Supreme Court of the United States agreed. And it's pretty contemporary considering, you know, we just had a presidential election and everybody, a lot of discussion about abortion and all of these issues. So it's contemporary today. The real difficulty with this case was, not only was it a tough case and there was a lot of litigation, we were flying all over the country. When we won the case, this was kind of the capstone of that movement. But what happens in social protest movements sometimes is they overstay the welcome. And the country, the rescues were successful, they had made their point, but then they kept doing them, and now federal legislation came into play where they passed an act, which basically was the Free Access to Clinic Entrances Act. Then they filed RICO charges, which we ultimately won at the Supreme Court too. But it took another, if you can believe this, another 8 years of litigation to rectify all of those cases. So it was very, very complex litigation. Then we got to go from, so they had the pro-life stuff going on at the same time as the religion cases were percolating. We won the school case. We'd won the Operation Rescue case. And then we get a call from this church that wants to show a film series by Dr. James Dobson called Turn Your Heart Towards Home. And they wanted to show it at the Santa Mauritius School District in one of the high schools there. And it was Lamb's Chapel Church. And they wanted to show this film series, and the school district said, I'm sorry, they weren't just put this in writing. I love when schools do this. This is church related, therefore you can't show it here. And that one ended up at the Supreme Court of the United States also. Lamb's Chapel was kind of the sleeper. It was an important case and grew in its importance as time has gone on. There, a church simply wanted to share a film series about family values in the evening with the citizens of its community. And they were rebuffed. They were told that content of the film was a violation of a policy that you can't have, quote, church-related information being given out at a school facility.
In 1988, this Long Island church, Lamb's Chapel, asked the Santa Mauritius School District for the use of this high school gymnasium to show a film series on family values. The series is called Turn Your Heart Toward Home and is produced by Focus on the Family. But the school district refused the request, saying the film series' religious content violated a New York State law prohibiting religious activities on school property.
We represented Lamb's Chapel, the little Protestant church in upper state New York, in its David and Goliath struggle against the state of New York attempting to censor its speech and preclude it from showing Jim Dobson's film, Turn Your Heart Toward Home, in a public high school auditorium after hours.
A great series on the family, strengthening the family with a good, strong family values message.
When a school district or when a government municipality allows general speech, you cannot eliminate religious speech or give it a special disability because you disagree with it.
According to the attorney for the Santa Maria School District, every school that rents to a church is violating the Constitution. That's crazy.
The First Amendment does not tolerate discrimination on religious speech just because a school district doesn't like it.
The state has said, if you're religious, you lose.
Here's what the New York Attorney General thought about religious advocacy and why it should be excluded from the marketplace of ideas. Here's their quote. Religious advocacy serves the community only in the eyes of its adherents and yields a benefit only to those who already believe. This is Justice Scalia's words, which I believe are almost prophetic.
I grew up in New York State, and in those days they used to have a tax exemption for religious property. Is that still there?
Yes, Your Honor, it still is.
But they've changed their view, apparently.
Your Honor,
it used to be thought that that religion, it didn't matter what religion, but some code of morality always went with it, and it was thought that, you know, what was called a God-fearing person might be less likely to mug me and rape my sister. That apparently is not the view of New York anymore.
Well, I'm not sure that
has this new regime worked very well?
Justice Clarence Thomas asked Santa Maria's attorney, John Hoffling, if his client would allow 10 atheists to debate one minister in front of an atheist audience.
Let's say 10 atheists debating one minister.
I submit that the school district nonetheless has the right to keep that particular type of activity from occurring because of our concern about religious uses.
So the addition of the minister is a problem, regardless of what the content is or
yes,
opposition is.
Under those circumstances, I would submit so.
The communists can discuss family issues. The agnostics can discuss family issues. The atheist can discuss family issues, but a church cannot discuss family issues because of its religious perspective. That should not be tolerated by the First Amendment.
The school district in Santa Maria's, New York, routinely allows outside groups from the Cub Scouts to a kennel club to use the auditorium at the local public high school after school hours. But when Lamb's Chapel, a small evangelical church, wanted to use the auditorium to show a religious film about child rearing to anyone who would come, school officials said no. That would violate separation of church and state. The church appealed, and today, Justice Byron White, writing for the Supreme Court, rejected the school board's arguments and said denying access violated the church's right to free speech.
We won that case unanimously, and then a whole arena, if you will, of litigation exploded.
Built upon those precedents, like Lamb's Chapel, more and more court decisions are coming forward, protecting and defending the rights of the individual Christian believers and the church.
That's going to do it for the broadcast today, folks. Again, I encourage you, join with us. Become part of the team here at the ACLJ. Any amount you donate, we get a matching gift for. And that helps us fight for freedom around the world. ACLJ.org. That's ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255. ACLJ.org or 1-877-989-2255.
Now, for a limited time, your gift will be doubled. A $25 gift becomes $50, $100 becomes $200. The ACLJ's Matching Challenge matches dollar for dollar every contribution made to the ACLJ. The Matching Challenge is ending soon, so take a moment today and support the work of the ACLJ and double your gift. Make a difference online at aclj.org, or you can call 1-877-989-2255.